You're listening to the Net Mums podcast with me, Wendy Gollidge.
And me, Alison Perry. Coming up on this week's show...
I've got no idea how hard it is to get kids to understand why it is always right to tell the truth when they look on their televisions and the people who are telling them how to live their lives and how to wear a mask and lockdown and all that stuff are proven liars, like Johnson and Trump.
But before all of that...
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode. Now, we are fast approaching Halloween, and it has brought up a bit of an issue in my house. And Wendy, I want to know if you are having a similar kind of thing happening and what your views are. Basically, my 14-year-old, she's just turned 14, she wants to go trick-or-treating with a friend of hers in our local area. And I have said to her, it's a hard no.
No.
I'm so glad you agree. Because I was starting to question myself, because I just feel like I'm not really sure that it's safe for her to be wandering around in the dark with a friend of hers. But also, if some granny opens the door and, you know, she's got two teenagers on her doorstep, I feel like that's potentially not okay. Like, she might feel intimidated. What do you think?
I'm kind of like the Grinch of Halloween. I don't really do Halloween. I think it's American and a bit shit, and I'm not really sure. My little kid really likes it, and we go, and it's fun. But I think for older kids, no, just shouldn't be doing. I'm quite militant about it. I don't like it at all.
As a Scot who grew up guising, it definitely isn't American shit.
Yeah.
That's what we used to call it back in Scotland. And we used to turn up and do a turn. We would like say a poem or do a song, and then our reward the sweets. It was a whole thing. So, you know, I think the Americans stole it from the Scots. Most things we invented.
Okay. Well, I would like to know, can you imagine if our guest had taken himself trick-or-treating in the 90s? That would have been a shock for some people. So let's introduce him and see if he's a fan.
Well, we're joined today by someone who has been a key player in politics and the media for the last few decades, from being a journalist to being Tony Blair's right-hand man in the 90s and noughties. Alistair Campbell now hosts two hugely popular podcasts with Rory Stewart, The Rest is Politics and Leading. It's fair to say he knows a thing or two about the British political system. And he's now written a book for young people, Alistair Campbell Talks Politics, where he shares his knowledge and passion for politics, hoping to empower young people and give them the skills and confidence that they need to understand how the country is run and how they can get involved. Alistair, welcome to the Net Mums podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. And I'm with Wendy on Halloween. Absolutely. Absolutely. 100%. And, you know, I just go out, because otherwise you just sit there with the doorbell going endlessly and people sort of looking down at you, the quality of the sweets that you're giving out. And it's sweets are bad as well. So no way. Thank you for having
humbug.
Me.
Humbug.
Yeah. You're very welcome. So let's kick off with an easy question. Your kids are all grown up now, but when they were small, what kind of dad were you? And are you different now that they're in their 30s to when they were smaller?
Oh, you should probably get them on and ask them. I think what I'd say is that I tried my best. I always tried my best, but it was pretty difficult. Given that, so if I take Grace, the youngest of our three, who's now 30, she was a baby, literally like a few weeks when I first moved from journalism into working for the Labour Party. And so she's literally known nothing else. The other two did know something else, which was, so like my oldest son, for example, I was the political editor of the Sunday Mirror when he was born. Now, I don't know if you know much about Sunday newspapers, but it wasn't the hardest job I've ever had. So, you know, Sunday I was off, Monday I was off, Tuesday I was probably off, and I could work from home quite a lot as well. And then I was on the Daily Mirror when Callum was born, I was working for Tony when Grace was born. So I think just this sort of progression, but I always tried to be there for them. And I think when you say about what's the difference when you get older, I think it obviously depends on your relationship with them and what they end up doing. But I'd say the challenges are, you know, there are always big challenges. It's just that they change. We're still pretty hands-on parents, I'd say.
And did you manage to have some kind of semblance of normality when they were little? Like, were you able to, you know, make it to, you know, the school plays or go trick-or-treating with them when it came to Halloween?
The latter, thankfully, Tessa Jowell, who was a member of Tony Blair's cabinet, she loved going trick-or-treating. She loved it. So she was basically a surrogate parent to Grace when that was happening, and she would literally, and I always got the feeling that once Grace started to sort of grow out of it, Tessa still wanted to do it. So but no, I would not be doing that, but everything else, yeah, I mean, I would definitely always try to be at parents' evening, school play, Christmas stuff, and also to do stuff with them. Both of my sons are pretty obsessed with football, and I think one of the reasons is that I always made an effort with them to, when they were playing, when they wanted to go to games and stuff like that. But I think that the truth is, I think we're kidding ourselves if we can, you know, if we think that you can be the perfect parent when you're doing the sort of job that I was doing and having the sort of life that I was living.
I think very, very hard. That sentence at the parent.
I was going to say that.
I think we're kidding ourselves if we think we can be the perfect
no,
parent.
No, I think that's true. But I think that what you often hear people saying is, oh, well, you know, it's a question of, you know, making time and the quality of the time. So, for example, the quality time thing, you know, I can remember times when, and Fiona would, my partner, she would spot it when she'd say, look, you're here, but you're not here. And I was very conscious of that, that sometimes you'd sort of think you were doing the family a great favour by finally getting home at an ungodly hour or finally having a weekend when you were at home, but then your head wasn't there. And I think that's the hardest part, is when you're trying and you kid yourself that you're trying your hardest, but frankly, it's not good enough.
And did the kind of circles that you were mixing in have an impact on the kids growing up? You know, were Tony and Cherry coming round for tea, or was it all very separate?
Well, I think if you go and see Grace's comedy, she's a pretty effective name dropper about childhood experiences. I think you couldn't pretend it was a totally normal child, I don't think, for them. But I, you know, so what we tried to do was to make it as normal as possible. But at the same time, yeah, they would meet people like, I mean, Grace does a whole sketch about how she met. She's one of the few people in the world who's met Vladimir Putin's kids. So, you know, it's like, you know, you can't pretend that's normal. But I like the fact that she's gone off and sort of now uses all that sort of stuff for her comedy. But at the same time, I think that, you know, most, as you were saying earlier, Wendy, most people's lives are struggles of different sorts. And it was just, you were conscious of it being different. And I think the other thing that happened when my three children all had very different relationships, if you like, with the fact of being with me when I'm out and about and you have all sorts of interaction with the public.
And with the
media, you know, it's like I can remember once when Grace would have been quite small, you know, so she was I think still at primary school, and I was taking her out for a walk, and then this film crew was following me down the street, and I said, "What are you doing? You know, you can't film her." And he said, "Oh, don't worry, I'm only filming from your waist up." And I said, "Well, how the fuck is she supposed to know that?" So although, of course, you know, now Grace sort of will say she loves all the attention, all the rest of it. So, but the point is that you're trying to be normal, but it's not always straightforward.
Yeah. So what inspired you then to write Alistair Campbell Talks Politics? Why is it important to you to encourage young people to have that interest and inspire them to get involved?
I mean, the idea for this one actually wasn't my own idea. I've written 21 books now. Most of them have been my idea. But what happened is I wrote a book aimed much more at an adult market called But What Can I Do? why politics has gone so wrong and what we can do to fix it, what you, the reader, can do to fix it. And another publisher came along afterwards and said, look, you should do a version of this for kids, which was so blindingly obvious that I said, yeah, you're absolutely right. So I've done two. I've done the one that you've talked about, and then I've also done one for primary schools, Why Politics Matters. And, you know, the answer to your question is I think we're in a real mess. I think our politics is in a real mess. I think the country's in a bit of a mess. I'm very, very glad that we've got a change of government, but I think it's going to take much more than a change of government to turn it all around. And I worry about the extent to which people are literally turning away from politics. And what happens if that happens in sufficient scale, then what do you end up with? You end up with people like Boris Johnson being prime minister. You end up with people like Donald Trump being president. You end up with Brexit, with the day after the vote, the most Googled question in the UK was, what is the European Union? The day after the country has just voted to leave it.
So
we're talking about levels of debate. I think the media's had a lot to do with this. I think we have very dumbed down media. I think we don't have a very serious debate about policy and about politics. It's one of the reasons why I do the podcast with Roy Stewart. It's just to try to kind of try to explain how complicated politics has been at a time when a lot of the politicians want to tell you how simple it is. You know, just stop the boats, just put them on a plane to Rwanda. Just, you know, just do this, just do that. It's going to be so easy. Just come out of the European Union. All your problems are going to be over. Make America great again. All this kind of populist stuff. So basically what the book tries to do is to explain what politics is, how things like parliament and government work in very, very, very simple terms. And then particularly for the teenagers book, Alistair Campbell Talks Politics, for that one, to explain how you can make a difference, how you can get involved and you can make a difference. And, you know, there's lots of motivations why anybody would write a book and think that anybody might be interested enough to read it. But I guess it is sort of old-fashioned. Somebody actually phoned me the other day and said, this is the kind of stuff trade unions used to do. You know, where the trade union would sort of try to educate the public about the state of the world. So it's kind of just like trying to say to kids, politics isn't all bad. I understand why you might think it is, given your recent experience of politics, but it's not all bad. You can get involved. You can make change. And I always say this when I go into schools. I say, look, it's entirely possible. Do this. It goes down especially when in primary schools. It's entirely possible that one of you people sitting on that carpet now will end up as prime minister. Because in 30, 40, 50, 60 years' time, there has to be a prime minister. And you're then going to be in your 40s, 50s, 60s. Why shouldn't it be you? And once you explain that, what that means, how does it happen? How does somebody become the prime minister? What does a cabinet minister do? What does an MP do? How does an MP get elected? These really simple questions. And, you know, I find when I go into schools that once you're through the kind of what preconceptions they might have, and it's always best if they have none at all, you can actually explain, this is interesting, it's exciting, it can be fun. So that's what I'm trying to do, just get them interested and engaged.
You've interviewed some pretty significant world leaders. Is it scarier standing in front of a bunch of primary school kids than it is interviewing the world leaders?
Well, I've never, maybe this comes from my journalistic background, I've never felt very, very nervous just because another person is there. So I would argue it can be, yeah, because you definitely get better questions, I think, from kids.
Absolutely.
And the other day I went into the primary school around the corner where our three kids went to. They went when the books came out, they asked me if I would go and do an event there, and I did, and I went in. And so what they'd done is I'd sent them some books in advance, and they gave them out to the different classes who were going to attend and what have you. And then they went away and they had discussions. And one of the kids, he can't have been more than 7 or 8, but he had gone away and researched defence spending, like off his own back. And he started asking me about why we had allowed our defences to run so low. Wow. So that if, and he actually said this, if Putin invaded the UK, we would only have a couple of weeks of ammunition. And he'd got his... Now, and I just thought that was fascinating, because what it meant was he'd thought about it before, but essentially what happened is that the teacher had said, this guy's coming in, he's written this book, he's going to talk about this, and he'd gone away and done his own research. And so you get some amazing exchanges with kids. And so I think that part of the other, one of the other reasons is that I think there is so much sort of cynicism around the place, and I'm trying to get to them before their parents make them cynical, the media makes them cynical, politics itself makes them cynical. And the other thing that's happening, we think of young people as all being kind of, you know, right on, and, you know, they all care about the future of the planet, and they're all, you know, woke and all this nonsense that gets said about young people. But the fact is that if you look at, for example, what's happened in Germany recently with the rise of the far right, it's not just old people who are being attracted to authoritarianism, it's young people as well. One of the biggest drivers of the success of somebody like Nigel Farage as a politician is that he's been very, very effective at embracing stuff like TikTok, better than the more mainstream politicians do. And you'll find, take another example, somebody like Andrew Tate. It's very rare that you go into school these days where a teacher doesn't bring up the issue of Andrew Tate, because Andrew Tate, who's, you know, kind of vile misogynist, spreads all this sort of stuff about, you know, basically, yeah, it's outright misogyny for the most part. But a lot of young boys are really kind of into it, and they're into it.
And they're invested in it.
Absolutely. And it's they're invested in the investment that is leading to people like Tate and these right-wing influencers, you know, making quite a lot of money out of what they do. And that, I think, is... You know, it's just a way of, it's trying to make people alert to that's the stuff that's going on, and trying to say to the politicians, you know, you, whether you like it or not, you've got to be in that space, because you've got to be enthusing and interesting and make young people feel that these politicians have got something to do with me.
I mean, that's really interesting that you brought that up, because I'm really interested to know how we... So we know that young people are getting so much of their news and views from TikTok, even if it's not extreme stuff like Andrew Tate. My teenager came home a few months ago and said, Rishi Sunak is sending us all to war. Have you heard? Like, where did you hear that? TikTok. Mm.
Yeah.
What can we as parents be doing, in your view, to encourage our kids to be thinking about, you know, media literacy, about checking your sources, about thinking, who is this information coming from and what might their agenda be, you know, without them just switching off and saying, yawn, whatever.
Yeah, or worse than that, without them ending up thinking that there's actually no point believing anything. And if you think about where we are in world politics right now, so, you know, recently with the TV debate between Trump and Kamala Harris, and there was this amazing piece on CNN the day after where this guy who does their fact-checking, he just went through really rapidly. He went through all the lies that Donald Trump had told.
Amazing.
And just rebutted them one by one. I think there were 33. He did them in about a minute. And I think he said that Kamala had made one statement which he said was false. Trump had made 33. And when you have that, to go back into some of the conversations I have in schools, you have teachers and head teachers who, I remember at the time during COVID, saying you've got no idea how hard it is to get kids to understand why it is always right to tell the truth when they look on their televisions and the people who are telling them how to live their lives and how to wear a mask and lockdown and all that stuff are proven liars like Johnson and Trump. So that has to be challenged. But your question, sorry, Alison, was about what parents can do. I don't think we can expect our children to spend their whole time being media monitors of their own media consumption. Nor should we be making this cynical. But I think you should be saying that when you get the whole thing on a sort of very, very short package on a TikTok video, I think we should, and I'm afraid schools have to do this as well, and the whole thing about critical thinking and so forth, we have to persuade kids that part of communication is simplifying, making complicated arguments come down to something that can be easily communicated. But you are not going to get a sensible, reasonable policy argument about something that really matters to the world in a 20-second video that's designed to make you laugh. And I think actually it's all part of trying to make, I think we've got to become more serious about this stuff. Very interesting, by the way, I was just talking this morning to a guy in Australia, is the Premier of South Australia, a guy called Peter Malinauskas. And we interviewed him on the podcast a while back, and he is trying to ban children from having access to social media.
Yeah, I've seen this.
Now, what's really interesting about it is he commissioned a report by, I think it was a former High Court judge, about, you know, trying to devise a bill, how this might work. And they produced that report, on the back of which the federal government, the Australian government as a whole, has come in and basically said, we are minded to support this. And so I think that's really, really interesting example of how something, an issue where, you know, I'm sure you talk about it loads on your podcast, you know, an issue that lots of parents really, really concerned about, lots of kids are actually concerned about, but it takes a government to come along and say, what are we going to do? Now, it may be, it was interesting when we talked to Peter Malinauskas on the podcast, he said that the social media companies just weren't engaging with him. They just didn't want to know.
Of course they didn't.
Yeah. Now, I think that that's an example of government coming along, because probably only government can do that. Now, the social media companies will do everything to try and stop it. But, you know, it's part of... So that's in it. And here's in it. I was in a school in somewhere in South London a few weeks ago, and we just interviewed Peter Malinauskas on the podcast. And I said, so I've just been talking to this guy. He wants to ban your age, kids your age, from having access to social media. And they went, oh, no, can't do that.
Yeah, and they did.
Yeah, so hold on. So we had a debate about it. And everybody was saying, no, it's a stupid idea. It's part of everybody's life. You have to know what's going on. That's how I get my news. That's how I stay in connection. My parents need to know where I am, all that sort of stuff. And then one girl, she said, I think this is quite interesting, she said, because I'd like to be off social media. And I said, why? And she said, because I know that every day I am seeing things that I shouldn't. And also every day I'm seeing things that I find quite upsetting. Now, what happened after that was that other people started to stay the same. And by the end of it, it was kind of 50-50. And where the mood was, I'd say by the end, was people basically saying, I'll come off it if everybody else does. So, you know,
as a parent, we've had those conversations on a, you say we need a government to make that change.
No, I'm
on
saying,
on a smaller scale.
Yeah, no, go on, sorry.
On a smaller scale, it's going on in schools a lot, where if one child in the class gets a mobile or gets social media, then it spirals and all the other kids want it. And at the moment, the only control we have as parents is to talk as a group within that class and say, okay, well, we should all say that our children aren't going to have TikTok, or we should all say, and then it doesn't work because one parent gives in. And
I would argue that maybe when I was growing up, you would have had the same thing in relation to what the new football boot might be. That's peer pressure has kind of always been there. The reason why I say it takes government is because I think ultimately on something like this, and it may not work. I mean, I just don't know what's going to happen with this thing in Australia. But I'll tell you what it makes me think of. When this is a totally different issue, but it sort of underlines the process. And this is one of the stories I tell when I'm talking to kids about how change can happen, how you can make change happen. So, you know, when I was growing up, part of the sort of rite of passage of being a teenager is, you know, you smoke, okay? And you I became a very, very heavy smoker. And then eventually I went to see a hypnotist, and when our first son was born, and I stopped, and I haven't smoked since. But then the public debate about smoking and health, it took decades to get change. Decades. I remember when I was a journalist, there was an organization called ASH, Action on Smoking and Health. And they used to bombard us with their press releases about, you know, smoking causes cancer, smoking does this, smoking does that. And we would just put them in the bin because, frankly, the newspapers couldn't live without tobacco.
You sat there smoking at your desks.
At your desk, whilst looking through your paper where there was an advert there for Marlboro cigarettes or Embassy Regal, right? Now, we were part of the government that then actually stopped allowing advertising like that, sports sponsorship and so forth, and eventually outlawed smoking in workplaces, and including, you know, pubs and restaurants. Now, here's the interesting thing about this, why I'm so fascinated about this coming out of one state in Australia. When we first started to discuss that, we knew that the Irish government were also looking at it, and we said, let's just see how it goes in Ireland. You know, so Ireland, because Ireland with their drinking, smoking culture and all that, and Guinness and all that stuff, and the pubs, and it went well in Ireland. And that's why we did it. And then other countries did it. And now, you know, there are still countries in the world where you can smoke in pubs and restaurants and workplaces. But in general, we have become a healthier country. The world has become a healthier place because those campaigners whose press releases we kept ignoring never gave up. They just kept going. Other people kept going. You keep going with the data. So I just think it's important to, you know, you meet so many people who say, why is this happening? Why is that happening? Why can't we do this? Why can't we do that? And it sometimes feels so hopeless that everybody gives up. And I'd say that stories like that, whether it's, you know, the smoking ban, or it's, you know, some of the changes that's been made in the climate campaign, whatever it might be, whether it's the history of women's votes, the history of racial equality, the history of gay rights and so forth, it all happens when people campaign for it to happen. And along the way, every single campaigner, there comes a point of saying, this is completely pointless, it's never going to happen, this change is never going to come. And then, hey presto, change comes. Not always, but it does. It does.
So what's your view then on the voting age being lowered? Because that is debated quite often. You know, if it's lowered to 16, do you think that younger people should have more of a say in who runs our country?
100%. 100%. I've actually argued that for a long time. And I remember it was one of the few things that Tony Blair and I used to disagree about. He couldn't really see that it was that big a deal. I find kids way more interested in this stuff than we give them credit for. It gives people the locus to understand why they should be involved in those debates at a very, very early age. And it was interesting, you know, again, to go back to the Trump-Harris debate, on the back of which Taylor Swift came out with and told her 75 billion, squillion, trillion, zillion followers that she's backing Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. But I thought the way she framed it was really, really smart. She wasn't saying vote Kamala because Trump's a lying racist misogynist, whatever. She actually said, we've all got a responsibility to do our own research.
Yes.
I thought that was what I really liked about it. And I've looked at what they're saying and I've read about what they're saying. And I've thought about it and I'm going to be putting my support behind Kamala Harris. And I think it's just that sense of explaining that we've got to take it seriously. It does matter.
So I want to ask you about the lost art of disagreeing agreeably, which I think is a very great blurb line for your podcast. I think that for lots of young people, and you've touched on this a little bit already, but the idea of disagreeing with someone, but it not being a huge deal or a big argument, especially when they're hot-headed teenagers, is a foreign concept. And yourself and Rory manage it admirably. You don't have many on-air punch-ups, I notice. Well done.
We've had a couple.
I'm not sure what happens off-air, but we probably don't want to know.
No, it's fine.
So how did you kind of, what would you say to parents trying to get young people to listen and consider rather than reacting? I'm sure you had to do it with your kids as well. How do you teach that lost art of disagreeing agreeably?
It's so funny because I think my kids listen to me going on about disagreeing agreeably and they say, well, that's not what you do. So I think I have changed. I think I've become different, and I think the podcast in a way has changed me. It's quite a funny story, the background to this, because the actual phrase disagreeing agreeably, Rory Stewart was horrified when I told him this because he's not a big fan of John Bercow, the former speaker. But actually, it was John Bercow who said to me, I was at an event and he was there and we were chatting away, and he said, you know, the thing is, Alistair, we've lost the art of disagreeing agreeably. And this is just as I hadn't even started the podcast by then, but that was where it sort of, you know, implanted itself. So it's a sort of deliberate strategy for the podcast. Thank you. I'm glad you've noticed. But I think when you say how do you, I think in most people's lives they are disagreeing agreeably. You know, I think when you look, if you live your life on social media, people are shouting at each other and calling each other names and all that stuff. If you watch the news, it's kind of, you know, there's a lot of that going on. But most of the time, most people are not having those sorts of conversations. They have those sorts of conversations either when something important is really at stake, or when there is a kind of sense of misunderstanding and people not actually listening to the other person's view. I think the most important thing is what we try to do. It's genuinely trying to listen to what the other person's saying and not always listening to who they are, who that person is, and the tone in which they're saying it. It's very tricky. And I've got a temper and I can really get riled up very, very quickly. But I have definitely got better at doing that. We don't need to disagree agreeably because actually we're not disagreeing about anything here. You've asked me a question. I've explained the background to the answer to the question. And we're both now in agreement that it's better to converse like this than it is to say, no, you're right, I'm wrong. You're wrong, I'm right. So, and that makes for a better conversation. I think the other thing to say is that, and this is where, again, I think that the way that politics has developed hasn't really helped. I think there was a sort of basic understanding when I was growing up and when I was younger, maybe even when I was a journalist, that the political process was actually a kind of never-ending thing where debate around big issues and specific smaller issues, you know, the big thematic stuff about state of the world, future of the country, communism, capitalism, all that big stuff that was going on, that there was a sense that was what politics was about, was that never-ending debate. And what debate means is that you argue about things. And sometimes the arguments flare up and they end in a choice. A choice has to be made. Are you voting for this or are you voting for that? Are you passing this law or are you passing that law? Are you going to amend it in this way? Are you going to amend it in that way? But I think that we've slightly lost that, and that what politics has become much more almost a sense of part of the entertainment industry. It's, you know, I'll tell you when I felt it was going really badly wrong. There's nothing wrong with with public wanting to like politicians. But that whole thing about, you know, oh, well, say what you like about Johnson, but it makes me laugh. Mm. You know, say what you like about Donald Trump, but I could imagine, you know, I'd really like to go for a game of golf with him and have a laugh with him. You know, we've got away from that idea. This is what Rory Stewart's book is about, really, is that we've lost the sort of the understanding of the seriousness of politics. So what I've tried to do in the books is in a hopefully accessible way is say, look, I hope I can make this interesting and entertaining, but it is serious. It is serious. Politics is a serious business and we need serious people to think about it, to think about being involved in it, and also to understand that politics isn't just for politicians. We're all of us in politics, whether we like it or not.
Yeah. Now, you famously parted ways with the Labour Party, but what are your hopes for this new Labour government, especially when it comes to families and young people?
Well, I mean, I didn't part ways. My way was parted for me by Jeremy Corbyn when he was the leader because he kicked me out. But I've always been Labour and I suspect I always will be Labour. Look, my hope for this Labour government is that they really do fix the mess that we're in. And I think when you're talking about, I guess if I had to pick on a couple of specifics in relation to families and young people, I mean, we're speaking at the time of they've got this big review of the National Health Service. I would like to see a complete transformation in the way that we deal with mental health. which understand that we need to move away from what we have now, which is a mental crisis service, and actually develop the sense of a mental health service where we're investing in kids' mental health, and we're actually hopefully creating a situation where fewer and fewer people end up in crisis. Because I think at the moment that's all we have is if you end up in crisis, if I jumped off this, you know, I'm at the top story of my house now, if I jumped off the top now, they'd find me somewhere, they'd look after me somewhere tonight, because that would be viewed as a genuine crisis. You'd try to jump off a building. But if all the different steps between, you know, not feeling great to getting to that, if there was just a way of kind of, you know, intervening at those points with something that could be very, very, very simple. And so that's the first thing I'd say. I think that I'd really like to see a different approach to mental health. I think I'd like to see more, I think I'd like to see more optimism and understanding about the positives that young people bring to. I think they get a very bad rep. I mean, partly it's a media thing. I'm not saying that young kids are perfect. They're not. But I just feel that they need to be trusted more and invested in more. I don't mean invested in financially, invested in more emotionally and intellectually, to be seen as part of the solutions to the problems that we're facing rather than them being the problem. And then I think that, you know, more broadly and more generally, I think that one of the real lasting damages that's been done by recent years, and I keep going on about Johnson because I think he is the sort of symbol of this, is I think if we're going to turn the country around, we are going to have to turn around attitudes to politics and public service. And so I'd just like to see from this government professional, competent, honest, levelling with people political debate that leads sometimes to doing things that the public don't want done, but at least treat them as grown-ups and explain to them properly why you're trying to do it. So I think I'd say mental health, proper, you know, modernizing the education system so that kids feel that they're actually in an education system that is relevant to the modern world. And then I think turn around attitudes to public service by showing, not by telling, but by showing that there is a different and better way to do government.
Now, as we've mentioned, your book's about empowering young people in the political world. But if you could go back in time and tell young Alistair one thing, what would it be?
Don't smoke at your desk.
I was going to say, put that fag out and put that drink down. I was going to say that.
There we go.
I've now not smoked for 37 years, but I still have issues with my breathing, with asthma, and I don't know that it's smoking related, but I wouldn't be surprised. I think the other thing I would say to myself, even though I've had and hopefully can continue to have a good and interesting and varied career, I think I probably would back then not have said to myself things that I do now say, as I said to you earlier, to kids when I go into schools. I think I probably did have quite limited aspirations for myself. So I think I would say, actually, do you know what? Don't have any limit to your aspirations. Don't think there's anything you can't do. Now, the truth is, there are loads of things I know I can't do. I'm not scientific. I'm not technological, as you know, which is why I was 9 minutes late for this podcast, trying to work out how to connect. So there are certain things I know I can't do, but there are other things which I think back when I was talking to a young me, I would have assumed I would never be able to do, which I've ended up doing. So I'd say, yeah, I think don't limit. Don't be arrogant. Don't say I'm better than everybody else and I can do what the hell I want, like the sort of Elon Musk approach to the world. But do say to yourself, do you know what? If I really work hard and if I really think about things and I work out what I'm good at and I do them well, there's no limit to what I might be able to do. So I, when I'm going around talking to younger people, I think the only thing I notice in the difference between kids, say, in a poorer area and kids in a more affluent area is about aspiration and confidence. It's about actually feeling they are entitled to think that they might be able to do something that, you know, their background is telling them is out of their reach. I think that's a real problem in this country.
There's a lot to think about there, Alistair. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. We very much appreciate your time.
My pleasure. It's been great. Thank you for having me.
Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on all social channels, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. Just type in Knitmoms and you'll find us. And if you liked what you've heard today, we'd love for you to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button, and share the podcast on all your socials.